On this edition of Discologist, Eduardo and Kevin are chatting with legendary musician Bill Frisell. Yes, you heard that correctly. Bill Frisell is the guest on Discologist today. How did this happen, you ask? Magic. Because Bill Frisell is mostly made of magic. Any other questions? No? Right then. Let's get to it. Your experience begins now.
They react. But we know why they're cheering. I think there's a lot of people cheering. For this one, us included. We are, dear listener, in the audience on this one. You might have guessed, because you can read the title of this, that
I don't want to sort of put any of my baggage on our listeners. So maybe it's possible that people haven't read and that they're just going in completely unaware of what they just hit play on.
Okay, well, no spoilers. So we're talking to Bill Frisell today. We talked to Bill a couple of weeks ago. Honestly, the morning I released The Lake. So that in itself was just a surreal experience. It was just like, I so bad wanted to ask him, be like, hey man, if I send you this, can you tell me what, but that would have been greedy.
Yeah.
That would have been so greedy.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're talking to Bill Frisell. You know, for our listeners who don't know who Bill Frisell is, he's considered one of the greatest living guitarists, one of the greatest guitarists of all time. He's a guy who's not just changed, but like I think defined like the sound of American music in his own bubble. And we talk about this a little, but like, it's just like he's jazz, but he's also outside of jazz. And there's very few people, like Miles Davis is one of these people. Stevie Wonder is one of these people, you know, that are just something outside of the music.
Well, there's not a lot of, my first encounter with Bill Frisell's music came on a Ginger Baker project called Falling Off the Roof or something. And it was Ginger Baker, Charlie Hayden, Bela Fleck, and Bill Frisell,
right, yeah.
Maybe. It's like a weird, yeah, it's a lovely little thing. And that was probably in 1996 or something like that, that I think that CD first came into my possession. And I can tell you there are very few musicians who have been as active as Bill Frisell and who I have kept up with for, you know, nearly those 30 yeah. years or something like that, with the same level of energy and enthusiasm. And there's really something to that feeling of, like, you know, growing and changing alongside an artist's, you know, alongside their own progression, and sort of feeling like, you know, even though we're of different ages and all that, but just sort of finding all these different connection points and these ways in which stuff that he put out that, you know, you didn't connect with at one age, you might connect with
right.
10 years later. I think his career and his sort of position too, like he is basically one degree removed from just about every musician in my music library, I bet. You know, we could probably scan this down. There's probably a couple of metal bands where we have to do, like, maybe he's 2 or 3 degrees removed from them.
Right.
But basically, like, any jazz musician, any bluegrass musician, any sort of contemporary songwriter, anyone that I have more than one recording by, Bill Frisell is probably 1 or 2 degrees at most removed from them, and that's just remarkable.
It is, and it's due to a life of like dedication to music. A lot of what you're going to hear us talk about is his new album, Orchestras, which comes out on the 19th, which will be this Friday. He collaborated with his friend Michael Gibbs, longtime partner, older guy, older than Bill. Bill's I think like 72 now. And made this album of material that Gibbs charted out to some point, which you'll hear us talk about this, for a 60-piece Philharmonic, the Brussels Philharmonic, and then an 11-piece orchestra, the Umbria Jazz Orchestra. And the results are really hard to describe, because there's this idea at first that you're listening to something that is very composed, and then you realize that no, you're not. You're actually listening to something that is like, the guidelines were set, but then there's basically, this is improvisation. I don't think I've heard a record like this. I certainly haven't heard it from Bill Frisell, which is saying a lot, because you've, like I said, any type of thing in music you can think of, Bill Frisell has done it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think what jumps out at me on orchestras is, a lot of times with these kinds of projects, you can sort of tell what part of the song you're in. And by that, I mean, you can sort of tell, are you in a composed section of the piece, or are you in the piece where they sort of are allowed to stretch out for however many bars? And what's interesting about orchestras is it really does feel, and this is such a cliche, but it's very true in this case. I mean, it really does feel like each piece is sort of an organic whole that's kind of moving according to its own logic and its own needs. And so you never have that feeling of like, oh, they've gotten to the point now where they're allowed to sort of stretch out and solo. It feels like the small group and then the extended string section are all sort of moving together in this very deliberate and controlled way. And that's really hard to do.
It's crazy. Let's play a little bit of that so people know what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
This is from this LP2 is the 11 piece, and this is a strange meeting with the Umbria Jazz Orchestra. He's playing with this trio too, Thomas Morgan and drummer Rudy Royston. So here's Strange Meeting off of the second disc of Orchestras. Strange Meeting off of Bill Frisell's Orchestras, the way that all comes together is so... and we talked about this in the interview with him, a love of like television and television's themes and movie music. I mean, like he's not a snob about any of this.
Like,
yeah, I'll do the Bonanza theme, which he does on an album.
Yeah.
That song in particular, and then other songs on here, there's a fantastic version of Beautiful Dreamer on here. He ends with We Shall Overcome. There's some stuff that he keeps revisiting, stuff that he's done earlier in his catalog, just because he loves the song and wants to see not just what other people do with it, but what he'll do with it. at this point in time.
Yeah.
You know, the relationship.
I think that's
him to the song, which again is, I think, why he's so successful and so iconic.
Well, it's what gives his music this sort of unique combination of you know, it's sort of both very, very permanent and kind of fixed, and at the same time, very fluid and subject to, you know, revision and realtering. It is one of, you know, one of my little joys has been over the years, when a new Frizzell recording comes out, is to listen to it and, you know, not glance at the track list.
Yeah.
And then, you know, three or four tracks in, being like, wait a minute, I know this song. He's our, you know, this is a song of his from, you know, from the Willies, or from, you know, good Man, Happy Dog, or something, you know?
Yeah. There's a lot of that. I've got a couple albums like that where it just, I was listening to Dis Farmer. Which is a fantastic project that he did, and how those themes pop up on like, at least five other albums that I have, you know, and they're gorgeous themes. You know, it's been said that he is somewhat of a master of melody. I'll buy that. You know, I think our most successful musicians can find that melody in something. And I think it's okay to keep like hitting on it, because maybe it's a true melody. If you want to, you know, get all like, you know, poetic on it, you know, you could call it a secret chord. But, you know, it's something that he's tapped into that, as you'll hear, I think he believes everyone can tap into, which is important.
Yeah.
To remember when you're thinking about music. But remarkable musician, remarkable album. I honestly don't know how we ended up talking to him, but
I mean, there could be a whole sort of other fun show where we just tell the story of like the timing and how this all happened. Yeah. But you know, it's fun to not share some of those details and to leave you all in the dark as to how this magic happened. Suffice it to say, we were both really hoping that we would get a chance to talk to him, and it all came together fairly quickly. And we found ourselves like on a Friday morning, you know, with like coffee in hand. He was drinking coffee
with Bill, right? Frizzell.
Just having a little, it was a sunny day. We were just sitting here having a nice chat.
Yeah, it's good. So now you get to hear that chat. So we'll get out of the way. And here is our chat with the legendary Bill Frizzell, talking about his new album, Orchestras, and pretty much everything else. We'll be back in a few. We'll get into everything about you, but I want to start with this, just talking about this new album, Orchestras, which, you know, I've been listening to it for, I think, about 2 weeks.
Oh, wow. So you've heard it already. That's
yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, man. Fantastic job on this. You, for people who haven't heard this yet, you take a bunch of your songs, and your friend Michael Gibbs has rearranged them. And, you know, you've been playing with this trio, Thomas Morgan and Rudy Royston, for a long time. Your Blue Note albums have included these guys. You seem to have added a few people to the roster this time. When you started thinking about this album, because it's much bigger than your other Blue Note albums as far as staff and as far as sound, was it you wanted to expand the sound a little bit, or was it that you were interested in like presenting this stuff with Michael?
It's really so much about Michael Gibbs, who this is someone, it's not like some arranger that I, you know, no, he's like such an important part of my life going way, way, way back. I first heard his music when I was in high school. I like the first, if you want to call it, jazz concert I went to in 1968. I heard, I had just discovered Wes Montgomery And Wes Montgomery was coming. This is in Denver, Colorado. And he was supposed to come for this big, it was like a Newport Jazz Festival traveling. It was like a George Ween where they traveled around the country with this sort of, I think it was called, what was it? Schlitz Salute to Jazz or something. But it was a, you know, like a Newport, a traveling Newport Jazz Festival. And they played at Red Rocks Amphitheater outside of Denver. And the main reason I wanted to go was that Wes Montgomery was coming. I didn't know who any of the other people were. And, but then Wes Montgomery passed away right before the concert. But I already had the ticket and I thought, well, let's go anyway. So I got to hear Thelonious Monk and Cannonball Adderley and Dionne Warwick was like the big headliner person. And then there was Gary Burton's quartet with Larry Coryell and Steve Swallow and Bob Moses. And this is at a time, I didn't know what was going on. It's like my mind, when you say mind blowing, I mean that literally at that time of my life, you know, it's toward the end of high school and I'm just, you know, I grew up in Denver. It's not like there was a lot more music happening there than I realized, but I'm just saying my imagination was just exploding. And then to hear that right at that moment, this Gary Burton group, there was something like, what is this sound? There was some sound that I'd never heard before. And I started buying those records. And then I noticed there was this name that kept appearing, Michael Gibbs. So it turned out that he had written a lot of that music. And there was something in the melody and the harmony and the, you know, that really, really, that's where I became a fan. And then as I started finding out more about him and more, you know, one thing leads to another, I'm getting more and more serious about music. And in 1975, then, so it's like, it's weird how you think of these spans of time. It's only, was only, what, 7 years later, but a lot had happened in my life, you know. And I left Denver and I went to Boston to go to school, and I arrive and I couldn't believe it, but I didn't know he was going to be there, but he was there as a teacher. And so I felt like I had won the lottery or something. You know, here's one of my big heroes and he's there. He had just recently come there to teach. So I took all of his classes. I played in his student band. And then a couple of years later, I left Boston. I went to Europe. And then when I was over there, he asked me to do a tour in England. And that's where I met Kenny Wheeler and Charlie Mariano and Eberhard Weber. And that was led to me recording for ECM Records. Then I moved to New York and he was there in New York. So some of the very first gigs I did in New York were with Mike Gibbs there. So, and then all along, even when I was a student, you know, he would always be like, I'd have some little gig in a bar or something. And then there he is, he's hanging out in the back. You know, he's so, always been so tuned into what the players are doing. You know, he's really inspired. So he's been listening to me for all this time too. And so his sensitivity to what my music is and the way I play, it's just, you know, so much deeper than if I had just hired somebody to write an orchestra piece or something.
Right. For sure. And I mean, he seems kind of like your origin story, and you guys' lives seem like intertwined.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, so much of the way I hear things, you know, the way I hear harmony and melody, it really, a lot of it comes from him. And
well, it's interesting that you're a prolific collaborator, and those really feels like your approach is really kind of relational and not, you know, not transactional.
Oh yeah. Right? So it's so much, yeah. Really, that's what music has always been for me, is those relationships with the people. That's, you know, that's from the first moment when I first got an electric guitar, and then my friend got one, and you sit there and that's what it was. It was like, this is a way for us to be together, you know? And that's what music has always been for me. It's not so much about the instrument or the, it's about the people more than anything.
I was going to say, along those lines, like, do you think of yourself more now as a guitarist or just a musician? Like, and the guitar is just what you choose to communicate with? Because I know you play clarinet as well.
I did long ago.
Well, you did, yeah.
But you
get points.
Yeah, I mean, I feel the guitar is like, that's more my true voice, I think, more than as I'm trying to find words. When I have that, it's like I'm looking at it right now. it's like some kind of a magic wand or something, you know. I can hear things. Like, if I just put it in my hands, I can hear things that I wouldn't be hearing as we're speaking right now, or I can see things or imagine things. It just takes me to it's like a, what is that? Somehow just focuses who I am, somehow helps me to just be myself.
Does Michael think of you like as primarily a guitarist? Because you guys seem to have this special language. There's moments on orchestras where there's a back and forth between you and the trio and the strings. And this is, I think, in a lot of your music, is like you have this wonderful ability to almost disappear, like in service of everything that's going on. And when it happens, it's breathtaking. Like, it's like, what is happening?
Well, like, yeah, I mean, like I said, that this relationship goes so far back, and he's so sensitive to, like, if you play one note on the guitar, there's so much more happening than just that one note. There's like a kaleidoscope of overtones, or like a rainbow of other things happening. You know, you just play an open E string, and it's like there's all kinds of stuff going on there. And he's like super sensitive to that. And so whatever he writes, it's just so connected to what he knows of my own sound. I mean, some of the things, I think there's even a few things on the album where he would take, I think this is true, like on, we played Lush Life, and he had listened to a recording of just Thomas and me playing Lush Life. And then he orchestrated some of that for the orchestra. Like, he would take things that we had played and have the orchestra play it. And then we're reacting to things that we had played before. Not really, but it's like you're hearing some sort of dream version of what we played. And then there was no, we had no parts, or there was no instructions for Rudy and Thomas and me. There was no rules for what we were to do. It was just, you know, it just this incredible world that we could enter into, and just, okay, let's, you know, We know what to do.
You feel it. It's somebody who plays guitar and has played in symphonies and stuff. That's the wildest thing about this to me, is you're improvising. Like, everybody's improvising, and it just doesn't. It for a second you think about it as a listener, and then you're just like, okay, this is something completely new and different. This is amazing.
Yeah, it was so. I mean, you could, that situation could be very, could be a lot of restrictions and weight put on you, but this was sort of the opposite, where it's just, okay, just here you go, just go wherever do whatever you want. And
well, you have this great, I think it's in the Beautiful Dreamer book, where you have this great quote about Jim Hall, which when I read, I was like, oh, that's actually the perfect explanation of Bill Frisell's approach, which is, I think you say he put a spell on the music, and without dominating it, he influences and orchestrates it from within. And, I think there's something, in terms of your playing, you're playing the guitar, which is not an instrument known for sort of subterfuge or for being sort of, oblique. And yet, on orchestras in particular, I had this moment where I was trying to understand that, the sort of how the orchestral arrangements and the trio piece were so interwoven together. And I thought, well, it makes sense, because Bill's playing is a little bit, it leaves a lot of room. And so the orchestra is there to kind of fill in some stuff that maybe should have been there all along. And then my next thought was like, wait a minute, that's not true at all, because when the orchestra isn't there, there isn't anything missing either, right? So it really is this kind of like perfect melding of these two things. I'm not really sure I've ever heard a sort of jazz trio and orchestra combo that really feels this organic. And I have to assume that it's the result of the sort of 50 plus years of, you would think of Gibbs as maybe a teacher to you, but I'm sure he would, if we were talking to him, he would talk about all the things he learned from listening to and paying attention to you as well, right?
Well, yeah, that was the thing all along. He's always, I think I said that before, how he would always be, even in school, he would be hanging out in clubs and with the students and checking out what everybody's doing. And he's so sensitive to what players are doing, that I think that's why he's definitely inspired by listening to people just play their instruments. That'll give him ideas for, just whatever he'll take things to sort of into unusual places with a personality or the limits of an instrument or something, and
did you feel challenged during these recordings? Did you feel like you were in an uncomfortable spot at times?
Yeah, it was
musically?
No, it was, it just felt like being home in a way. And then I have to say, like, the Italian one functioned more like a smaller group. There wasn't a conductor. There was Manuele, who was he's the director of that group, and that was more like he would be sort of make a cue or something, like this stop here. But it wasn't like he was where the Brussels Philharmonic was. I gotta give credit to the conductor, that Alexander. We really lucked out with that, because he really was the link. And I could feel his sense of where the time was, where the phrasing was. Like, I'm standing pretty much right next to him. And, when he would give a downbeat, or you could feel it, like if you're playing with the drummer that you want to be playing with and you hit it together, it was like that with him, his body language and the way he communicated to the orchestra. We really, that was so important, because that could be, if that wasn't there, then it could have also been more difficult, but this was where we could really breathe together, you know, because it's not, nothing is, it is about like breathing and feeling where the things are resolving or not resolving, and just, so he became part of the trio in a way.
To that point, it makes it feel like this is something that maybe, it's on a record now, but maybe can't necessarily be recreated very easily. Like, certainly you could tour with a 60-piece, but this is like a moment in time, and this is, I think, what is not just your music, but music in general, is when you can capture those.
Yeah, yeah. That's what's the way it is with music, even if it's the exact same piece being played. I mean, you know, the parts would be the same, but the notes might be the same, but you'd be in a different room, or the tempos would be different, or the, who knows what would be happening. And certainly what Thomas and Rudy and I would play wouldn't be the same at all. You know,
there's a lot of, across your catalog, you do revisit songs a lot, and it's not just songs like your songs, it's songs that you love. And is the reason exactly that, is that they're never quite done? If that makes sense.
Yeah. Especially as I'm getting older, it's pretty wild looking back on a song that I wrote many years ago. And, like, I'll see, like, wait a minute, what is, I'll see things in it that I never saw in the beginning, you know, and,
is that coming from a place of wonder or?
No, it's just in the nature, you know, like, I mean, there's so many songs, like some old song, like a standard song or something, like Days of Wine and Roses or whatever, that I've been playing for 60 years or whatever it is, or hearing. And I keep coming back to it, and I keep finding things that I didn't know were there. But then now it's starting to happen with my own. That's what's weird about getting old. Like, yeah. Wow, I didn't.
Yeah.
I can come back to my own stuff, and there's always something in there that you didn't realize was there, even if something that I thought I had made before. You just, the more you learn, you start to see these other pathways through it. And
is that a looking for like a melodic truth? I know in Beautiful Dreamer, right at the beginning, they talk about when you were younger, had a dream about sound, like some great beam. Yeah. Which is great. It's like psychedelic. It's fun. It's like, yeah, this is, of course, this makes sense. But is that like, you have an idea of a melodic truth that you're looking for, or that you have an idea around it, and the closer you can get to it, it's just better. It's not necessarily like, I have to find that.
Well, I mean, it's like, you never, that's what's, it can be overwhelming that when you realize that you can't get it, you just keep reaching for this thing, and you're never going to get there. So that can kind of crush you, you know, the weight of how infinite this thing is when you realize that you're not going to get it. So you have to be comfortable with the idea that you just want to be in the process of reaching for it. And so that's all I'm doing. It's just.
Yeah. And I don't know if that comes with like age. Obviously you react to stuff when you're younger, like very different, and you put these limits on it. But like, just even listening to music lately, I've come to that, and I'm like, this is great, but also accept it for just what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of a double, it's not like you can't just give up or think,
right.
You know, but, yeah, I don't know. And music is amazing. You know, it just keeps,
it really is.
It just keeps pulling you. I mean, I've said that many times before, but it's like, it, like one, just one note is like a question, right? It's just, all you have to do is play one note and it's like, okay, what, it leads you somewhere. There's infinite possibilities for what you can, whichever way you want to go after you play that one note. And there's no right or wrong or whatever you do, it's like a cascade or kaleidoscope of stuff that just.
And that note invites people in too. You could just play that one note and then all of a sudden somebody is in the room like, oh, I hear something in that note now.
Well, I hope. That's where I feel lucky too, like that there's some kind of an audience that's not expecting just some fixed thing. You know, when I, something that's just going to be the same every time, you know, so when I go do a gig, I think I've been really lucky that the people come, they know that it's not going to be a replica of whatever the last album was or some product that got put out there, but it's a, every time we play, it's like we're, my hope is that we're off the edge of what we know. You know, that's the most thrilling or the most inspiring place to be, is when the band and the audience and where you, let's just jump off and see what we can do with not knowing where we are, you know.
It's so interesting to me how you get there, because there's this great sort of contradiction that I hear in your work, and I hear it a lot in sort of practitioners of folk forms, right? So we can sort of sidestep the jazz label question, but just in general, I think, you know, being part of a tradition of musical folk forms, oftentimes, you know, you move it forward by trying to disappear into it or by looking back, right? So it's sort of, the progress is kind of arrived at, not through direct intent, but rather by trying to sort of be as faithful as possible to something else. And that ends up finding a new truth. It's a really, I've not quite been able to formulate this cleanly, but it's something I definitely hear in your work, which is that, and there's that great epigraph in the book from Rashawn Roland Kirk, I think, about how you can only go as far forward as you've looked back. I'm wondering, you know, you were talking about revisiting your own work and finding new things. How often are you consciously pushing for something new as opposed to trying to maintain yourself in a state of, you know, readiness or openness to it so that it comes to you?
I mean, what you're making me, causing me to think about that, like, if I'm looking back, it's, I'm trying to, I want to be in this state of, like I said, about not knowing what's going to happen. So, and to be just thrilled, like a little kid when you discover something for the first time, how amazing that is. Like, to try to trick yourself into imagining, like to look at something that, like, okay, Lewis, I've said this, like, imagine if it was 1927 and you'd never heard Louis Armstrong. Like, now, okay, it's just, we know what Louis Armstrong sounds like, right? I mean, again, every time I hear him, it's like, what? It blows my mind. But imagine if you'd never heard that before. Like, if you're walking down the street and there's a bar, you open the door and there's this guy in there. That's like the most outrageous. Talk about outer space. You know, that, imagine what that would have done to your mind if you heard that without having. And that's kind of the place I'm. So if I'm looking back, I'm also thinking about what was it that made these, how did this happen? You know, how did, like, Robert Johnson, what in the world, what, how did he, where is this coming from? You know, and this and to try, and then to try to somehow use that with what my own life, like, how can I make something that's true to where I am now? And I don't know, it's hard to talk about.
Because it becomes not necessarily about notes, right? There's something intangible. Because I think what you're talking about, walking by and seeing that person, or even we talk about a lot, if you hear a record and you're like, oh, what was that piano player? And then you can just look up and pull that thread and look up everything about that piano player. Like, music, more than anything, I think, offers this opportunity for infinite delight.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you might not get anything else done with your life.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
might be okay.
Well, that's, yeah. I mean, you could, any one of these tiny little, anything we've talked about, you could spend your whole life just, you could listen to that one note I was talking about. Just keep playing that, you're never going to, so.
I've often used your, the version of Moon River that you did with Petra Hayden, I think, which ends on that beautifully kind of unresolved note at the end. It almost ends in sort of a musical question mark, as just an example of the power of one sort of slight harmonic shift at the end of a recording that really feels like, and now I've heard it so many times that the first few times I thought, oh, it's interesting how they didn't quite resolve it. Of course, now it sounds completely natural to me, and it sounds like it does resolve exactly where it needs to be. It's just such a small thing, I think, that you guys did to a song that most of us hadn't heard anything new in a while, and yet you found it.
I can't remember what I did there exactly, but I hope it was okay.
You know, on the subject of songs, you know, you are you tend to have been exploring a lot of the American songbook. You did. There's two different things that I want to ask you about. One is your album When You Wish Upon a Star, where you dive into film and television. What specifically about those compositions like drew you to that? Because I mean, I was just listening to it last night, and it's the definitive, for me at this point in time, version of this stuff. And I own a lot of that stuff anyways, the original.
Uh-huh.
No, I'm gonna, this is a alternate universe version, and it's fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, at that time there was this was a few years ago. I think what got it started was there was this Jazz at Lincoln Center series of concerts, and I was, I don't know what my title, I had this opportunity to do these different concerts, and I had to think of a theme for each one. And what one of them was, I said, oh yeah, there's all this television music and film music that's so much a part of, you know, my growing up. Like, I really attach you know, I was born in 1951, right? So it's just a few years later when my family first got a television. And I remember that my father coming in the house with this big box, you know, then it's like, and setting up this thing and putting the antenna up and then start watching TV. I've been watching TV my whole life. So I mean, that's like such a huge part of, it's all tied in with the music that I've heard, you know, so much of it came from there. And then thinking about the musicians that made that music, man, it's incredible. The level of musicianship on whatever cartoons or all those shows in the 50s and 60s. Just the other night, I was in a hotel or something. There was an episode of Perry Mason, and there was this whole segment, like some sort of chase scene, and whoever wrote that music, I don't know if it was, I know Bernard Herrmann did a lot of the Twilight Zones, and so there's all kinds of music that he wrote that's probably not known as well as what he did for Hitchcock or whatever, but But just, and then the level of the players, and I got this compilation of all these television themes from 50s, 60s, you know, and I'm listening closely and wow, these are actual human beings that are playing this stuff in a room. You could hear the room and you could hear, you might even hear some mistakes or something, you know, things that become part of our, what became part of my whole, where my imagination it was being formed. So anyhow, I'm taking way too long to get to the point, but just that music, I thought, well, wow, this would be, I should just take a look at this stuff and look more closely at it. It was just seemed like a great thing to try to play some of that music. And so we did a concert, and then it was like, oh, wow, maybe let's make an album about this. And that, it drew me into that world, thinking about also, like I said, thinking about those, the people that were playing that stuff, that so many unsung, amazing, the writers and the players themselves, that behind the scenes, they, you know, go in there and they play this badass stuff, and nobody ever knew their name. Or
it's really a lost side of music, of what music is, and like these people that are actually doing stuff, as opposed to like what's popular. That is, it's absolutely fascinating, especially, and it's fascinating to hear it reinterpreted. Like, I first really had music blow my mind was the John Williams Empire Strikes Back soundtrack.
Oh yes.
When I was 8 and my mom got it by accident, I wanted the storybook. I was like, no, I won't hear them talking yeah. about this, which still had music. And she brings me this double album, which I have to this day. It's big Darth Vader on the cover. And I'm like, who is John Williams? I'm 8. I don't care. And ever since then, I mean, that changed how I heard music, and it changed how I think about music. It changed it, like,
yeah,
everything.
Yeah.
It was like, this is so impossibly big. And yet it's like, telling stories that aren't even in this film, and you can, it's
yeah.
You made an album in 2020 called Americana with Gregor Murray and Romaine Collin that I don't know if it gets enough credit. I don't know what people think about it, but it was like, for me, and I think for Eduardo too, in some ways, like the album of the pandemic.
I forget when we recorded it, but it was a few years before it actually came out. So, you know, and that was really, I knew Gregoire, and we had been talking about doing something, and they had this thing together, and they asked me to play on it. So it really wasn't my album at all, you know, but, and so I went and we did it whenever that was. I guess there was some, you know, it was some time before there was a label and it was released, and then it just happened to come out during that time, you know. No, but those guys really made it. They just welcomed me into their world, and it was one of those. That's the other thing. It's so, recording is such a strange, you know, it's like a camera, you know, you just, bam, you catch that one moment. And so that was just some hours of, I might have just been there for one day. I don't know if it was one day, probably just one day. And then it's people take that and spend time with it, you know.
How do you, you know, on the topic of that album and sort of, you know, American standards in general, how do you sort of, I guess, what is your own relationship to your Americanness, or maybe to, you know, American music in general? Because it strikes me that, you know, a big part of your early musical development, you had to leave the U.S., right? You were in Belgium, and you had this very sort of defining time over there that helps you find yourself. You've, of course, played with Vinicius Cantuaria, with Shakti, you know, you have all these sort of, you know, so I'm saying I realize that's, you know, American is as reductionist as maybe jazz is in some senses. But at the same time, when I think about someone who can pull together, you know, the band that you had on the Nashville record, Aaron Copland, you know, your experience playing with American jazz musicians, it does seem like you've sort of, you know, your career can sort of serve as a wide lens on American music from, you know, the 1960s until the present moment.
Well,
does that?
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's something I don't really think about it. It's just like what I was saying about growing up watching TV, and it's like everything is sort of there. It's, you know, I grew up in Denver in a, you know, just sort of a, well, no, I was going to say like Leave It to Beaver, you know, or like we grew up in the middle of Denver, Colorado, where we had a house and my father would go to work every day. You know, I go to school, I ride my bike, I delivered newspapers. And growing up during that time with, you know, the civil rights movement, the Vietnam War, all the music that was happening, I sort of grew up as rock and roll became, you know, and getting to hear a lot of those people in up close in a club, you know, or getting to see Jimi Hendrix in a gymnasium, you know, hearing the sound of his amps hitting me in the face, you know, and that stuff. It's, I'm not thinking about that I'm going to do this or do that according to, but it's just a part of my, it's just there.
Yeah. Is there, I was thinking about sort of other recordings that to me seem to exist in this, you know, in between, a bunch of other identifiable genres. And I think a lot of your work sort of falls into this liminal space. And the album that kept coming up for me was John Hartford's Morning Bugle. This is kind of a big swing. And maybe you've seen where I'm going here. I'm wondering, so it took me a second to remember that Dave Holland was on that record. And that's why it has this sort of like quietly, it's like subversively modal for like a bluegrass recording. And then of course you've played with Dave Holland. I'm wondering how, first of all, I'm wondering if that record was ever a reference point for you. That's kind of a big swing for me, but also, you know, how do you, you know, what is that, what is playing with Dave Holland like, and how do you, you know, what do you look for in someone who can kind of lay a foundation, but also subtly challenge you and kind of quietly undermine the harmonic structure you're putting in place?
I don't know. That's a huge question there. I mean, Dave, but when you said that, it's weird. Like I'm trying to remember if that was the first time I think it was the first time I played with Dave Holland was on this Kenny Wheeler record, Angel Song, and
yeah,
where there was, it was Lee Konitz, Kenny Wheeler, Dave Holland, and me, like no drums. And that was an incredible, that right there was amazing experience. But when you were describing that John Hartford thing, which I think I must have heard it or something, but there was you just reminded me of this. It was a very short little moment during that recording. I'm sure Dave wouldn't even remember this, but it was like, I don't know how to describe what this was. It was sort of like at the end of a song or something, and we played something together that was so much in that there was just this little bluegrass moment that we sort of connected on, and we sort of looked at each other and laughed or something. But I don't know what that has to do with what you're talking about. But no, there's so much music in all of us that sometimes it's not always seen, you know, there's always more than what people see, I think, you know, anybody, you can't get the whole picture by just one album or one concert, or everyone has a whole lifetime of stuff in.
I think that's a, because we're about out of time, I think that's a great place to land it. You can get a lot out of orchestras if you're listening, for sure. Yes. So everybody go out and get that. Thank you so much for taking the time, Bill. I hope the rest of your press day is
well. Thanks. That's good to talk to you guys.
Yeah, and happy belated birthday.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I keep getting older.
Okay, everyone. Well, that was it. For me, this is really exciting because I haven't listened back to this since we had the chat. Yeah. And it was really fun to kind of, you know, revisit a few different pieces of this. In hindsight, I think we might need, thinking about, you know, your comments at the top of the show, and his love of TV, we might need just like a whole other interview with him just to talk about his favorite TV shows.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if the channel's open, I think, I mean, you can tell how excited we were to be talking to him. But he makes you feel very like welcome. He makes you feel just like normal dude. And he is, I mean, musicians are just normal people. But it really was, you know, you get an hour with people in general. And you have to be mindful of that. But it was at the end of it, like, oh, I guess in about like 5 minutes, we're not going to be talking to Bill Frisell anymore. What's that going to be like? Yeah. And maybe you're wondering, listener, what's life like after you have coffee with Bill Frisell? it's interesting. Some little existential things going on. You know, did we, have we realized our potential now? I don't know.
Yeah, let me say this too to our listeners. If you were listening to that and you were thinking that's not a good question, or I can't believe these guys are talking or saying what they're saying or whatever, just trust me when I tell you that what we do to ourselves is much worse than what you could do to us in terms of our in terms of our performance, because it does get very existential very quickly when you're like, wow, I had an hour with Bill Frisell, and what did I do with that time? Did I use it
well? Right. But
so trust me, we've been agonizing about that ourselves since this happened. So you don't need to beat up on us. Okay?
I do love at the end of that, which is something that, you know, I've said a lot. It's good to hear other people say it like unprompted, you know, because I think it's just a belief as a musician that you come to, an artist, any type of thing. He's like, that basically, you know, there's so much music in everyone. Like out of everything we talked about and anything you can ever know about Bill Frisell, I think that sums it up. Like, if you go into your world looking at your world like that, then everything is magical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It really was, you know, and it's almost like in my mind when he said that, it's almost like suddenly birds started singing or something. You know, it just felt like an moment or something, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, Bill Frisell, everybody, we're going to start planning some other interviews. I think we're going to have Ab on. I want to talk to Rich Ruth, maybe.
Oh yeah.
There's a couple of things, if behind the scenes, if you are somebody who also does this type of work, it's good to have Bill Frisell to drop like, oh yeah, he was our last guest. You know, it's like, yeah, your guests will be in good company with Bill Frisell. But yeah, that was great. I hope you guys enjoyed it. I know we certainly did. And go and get the album, man. The album's great.
Yeah.
I don't know how long I've had it, but it's just like, man, this is the type of stuff. I will say this before we just get out of here so I can go listen to more Bill Frisell. For me, like, the only person left that I think would be a similar conversation that I really want to talk to is Ry Cooder. I think they're very similar. Yeah, I think they're very similar musicians.
Yeah.
And maybe we could get Ry and Bill at the same time. I don't know.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Yeah. So we'll be back next week. Well, to talk about all the music industry stuff. You know about AI is coming, a new AI. There's a new Fish song. The Sphere, you'll have gone to the Sphere. but for today,
I will have been to the Sphere at that point.
For now, just forget all that and just enjoy that you just had a conversation with Bill Frisell. To yourself. So, we'll talk to you in a few.